I'm sure anyone who drove the Valley Road before 1950 have not forgotten the old cable suspension bridge across the Skeena at 4 miles. It had a 4-ton load limit on it for years. When you drove on the bridge with any load at all, the bridge would sink under the weight, and then you were climbing uphill all the way across. Marshall Brothers Trucking from Hazleton and a few others hauled large loads over this cedar poles, cordwood, and lumber over it for years. I remember one time when Bill and I were hauling lumber into New Hazleton to load in the boxcar. We drove on the bridge, and I noticed a beer bottle laying on the running plank ahead of me. So I stopped to let the Bill out to throw the bottle off. When we stopped, the bridge just settled and sunk under the truck. Bill walked to the end of the bridge, and then I went to pull ahead. I just started to move ahead a little, and the truck stalled and rolled back, and the bridge squeaked some more and settled more under the weight. I had to slip the clutch to get it rolling again. Another time, when we were driving cattle into Southtown to load out for shipping, they were afraid to go onto the bridge, and they all bunched up at the end. When we finally got them on, they all went on in a bunch and started running. And the bridge just bounced up and down, and the sides were flopping on it. And I know none of us rode on with our saddle horses until after the cattle all got off. I'm sure there was a lot of pleasant and some not so pleasant memories went along with that old bridge. The first commercial logging done in the valley was cedar poles for Hanson Timber and Lumber Company. The first to log was Smith, Carlson, and Olson, and this would be in the 20s. They logged across the Skeena from where Rory Combs lived. All the hay and supplies were slid down the steep bank to the river and taken across on the ice in the wintertime and by boat in the summer. After this, men like Louis Hagen, Uncle Walter, John Haglund, Charlie Sterk, John Smith, Bill Smart, Jonathan Brown, Roy Wilson, and others did considerable logging. The poles were cut and peeled at the stump, and most of the time they were left there until they were dry, and then skidded and piled along the riverbank. In some cases where the poles were too far to skid, they were hauled in the wintertime by team and sleigh and piled along the river. They were then left waiting for the river drive the next fall. The poles that were cut not too far from the main road were hauled by truck and trailer into New Hazleton for loading.
River drive was quite an operation every fall. In the first year, they had mostly Swedes, Norwegians, and Finns, and Finns working on the river drive.
Oh.
And Bill Smart was the boatman. The last few years of the drive, Bill Smart run the river drive and had an all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was in the latter years. He had It was all native, yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, most years, river guys went fairly smooth, but odd year, they would have jams in the river where poles would jam up against rocks right in the river and then keep piling up. So one jam they had,
yesterday was 1,000 poles.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they ended up sawing, blasting, and it took them days to get it cleared off.
That was building the river, didn't it?
Yeah, it was going. Mm-hmm. But then after that, all the problem they had that year, the years after that, these bats got this way, a rock where they put spear booms in before they started floating these holes.
Yeah, and we still didn't have to go down there every day when when that was going, from the river that was on, we was up all the time.
I don't know how many times this happened, but they had lots of poles in the river, and the river come up. And once, too many poles hit the boom at Nass Fly, and they were picking up poles all the way down
to the coast.
Right. Oh, the boom wasn't holding. And we were all hung up, and then the river come up, and so they all come down at the same time.
Yeah.
And they were taken out at Nass Fly, which is downriver from Schoolcraft.
Well, there is some of those for many years at Nass Fly, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and then Uncle Jim run the donkey
into Nass Fly.
Oh, Uncle Jim, yeah.
Pulled it out of there.
Oh, yeah.
Pulled the poles out. But those shoots were something else. Some of those shoots were a quarter of a mile long. And the flat parts, you had to put a break in it, in the chute.
To slow the log.
To slow the log down.
They put a cross tie and hang a log into the chute. So that log coming down, you have to lift it.
Yeah.
And then you get down, they'd have to water it or grease it.
To get it going again.
To keep it across the flat. And then where they hit the river, sometimes you'd have to build that lake out into the river. So the logs would go out kind of flat, otherwise they'd dig in and burn the end.
Mm-hmm.
They'd go out flat.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So Solid takes a few, and we went down there.
Silas Johnson, he worked for Hagen this one fall, and they had a pile up at the end of the chute. The water there. So Hagen and Silas went down to roll the logs out to get them away from the end of the sheet. And Hagen was out on the pole, and he slipped through and lost his peavey. Slipped through into the water and lost his peavey. And he just his head sticking out of the water. And Silas, he looked down at Hagen and said, "Hagen, you're in the water."
Big news for him, right?
And Silas boarded with Hagen. And one day, Mrs. Hagen had rhubarb for dessert. And so she asked Silas, "Are you care for some rhubarb, Silas?" "No, thank you, ma'am." And to tell you the truth, she said, "Another fruit I don't indulge in too freely is buttermilk."
We used to look forward to that river drive every fall, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
One of us used to go on it, and then we used to deliver meat.
We never went on the drive, but on the
rolling in.
Yeah.
Up and rolling in the fall.
Oh, yeah. I remember old Sip coming to the office, so many pounds of this or that for the other ones supplied.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a misprint. I can remember real plainly when I was putting it through on the price of cabbage, and at 35 cents a pound, and which was that was a big price. You had heard of at the time. And I remember we had a laugh about that because I don't remember what the word price would have been. But now, that's it's pretty cheap.
Yeah, what do you get for beef then?
Not too bad.
Not too bad.
No,
I think we got around 50 cents, 50, up to about 55 cents, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it was quite a while before that. I remember a sergeant said he was in there, and it was 18 cents.
No, I think we got up as high as 55, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And we push a beef from the ice house and then just deliver it whenever they want it.
Oh, yeah.
Ship to Nash Y, we have a crew down there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Meat and vegetables.
Yeah. I at least 1 year. From the 17 mile base. That was an old German guy named Henry Cook.
Oh, at least when you're in the cook shop. But the... That was by the cook. What was his name? By
Henry Cook.
By Henry Cook.
Yeah.
But the water was too low to be...
Well, it wasn't very successful. They had lots of trouble.
Oh.
But then they drove the poles on the Skeena for it. Well, years.
When they were cutting those poles, they used to have to fall, limb them, and peel them, and they got from... 1 cent a foot, I think up to about 2.5 for the bigger poles.
That was before you guys got in there.
Oh, long before, yeah.
But nearly 30,
yeah.
Could it be?
Yeah.
Around there?
Usually, most times, well, I guess most of the times it's Scandinavians that were doing the peeling, that guy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there was some native, Jimmy Angus.
Oh, yeah.
But Oscar Fredrickson, he was George Houston.
Oscar Fredrickson, they told me two folks for a few years. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
During the hard times,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
But he used to
anyway.
Work his butt off up there and not come out, and then he'd go out and just, well, because we had a lot of loggers that way, and about a week's time his back broke.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the first thing he'd do when he went to town would be to get his groceries and any clothes that
he always had good clothes.
And
that had to be taken care of first, eh?
Yeah, and the rest of them on one big blower.
Sounds like fun.
In 1952, when the fisheries pushed in a road so they could remove a rock slide in the Babine River, rather, upstream from Kitsigas, this road went right through Johnson Brown's logging show, and we pushed a road into Bill Smart's old timber sale on the other side of the river. This ended the river drive.
Pole logging, that is, in 1949, right?
Yeah, that's the year that Molly got hit on the head.
Well, Wally got hit in spring. It was Friday the 13th, 1950, when you and it were logging up back of the ranch. What happened there, right?
Well, Bill was falling this cedar tree, which hung up in a birch. So I told Bill, while he let the birch down, I'd start limbing. And as soon as the birch started to give a little, the cedar fell, slipped off it, and the birch sprang back and come the full length of the cedar and hitting me on the right side of the head and fracturing my skull. It knocked me down, but not out, and the blood was just spurting out of my right ear. So when I got up off the ground, I put my hand over my ear to try to stop the bleeding, and we had about 3/4 of a mile to walk home. When we got to the house, well, Lil come over and did what she could to for me before Bill and Uncle Walter took me into the hospital. Of course, this was a breakup in the spring, and we got stuck on the way out. When we got to the hostel and I got in the elevator to go up, I just got inside the elevator when I threw up blood all over the floor, which really made me feel good. Benita Martin was working at the hospital then, and she was in the elevator taking me up, and she said, "Well, don't worry about it, Wally." There was a doctor by the name of Green who was relieving at the hospital at that time. He was an old army doctor who'd been on the same boat as Marty Allen was, that was sunk in the Mediterranean during the war. So I know they had a lot of tall tales to talk over when they met. But anyway, when I got to the room in the hospital, well, Dr. Green and Miss McLeod, who was a matron at the hospital at the time, worked on it for a while and did everything they could for me. And Lil came in and specialed for a few days. But after 4 weeks of good care, well, I was able to go home. I always remember when Buster Anderson come in to see me. He said, "You know, Wally," he said, "when I heard you got a tree had fallen on you," he said, "I was really worried, but when they told me it hit you on the head," he said, I knew you'd be all right." Road pushed in to Bill Smart's and John Smith's old cedar sale, which was back of Chris Larman's place. This place is owned now by June Larson Nash. When we started logging in there, we thought we were real modern pole loggers with a PD6 crawler tractor and even power saws. The loading had to be done off of landings, as there was no front-end loaders in those days. We logged cedar poles for a few winters until we finished the cleaning these sails off. And then we went back to sawmilling in the winters.
Hauling out green poles.
Hauling out poles to the
barcode. Yeah. Dealing at the landing. Well, then you got those extra long poles. I have pictures at home now.
Three
100
foot poles.
300 foot poles and pictures taken down Quesnel. They were setting one up in Quesnel. And they had to unload those at Houston and possibly other places to get across the bridge.
Yeah, because they had to push them out over the cap. And when the truck turned, the pole went through the
Yes, there's a picture of that and a write-up in the museum in Burns Lake. I was just reading it recently.
We thought, well, that was big money. We got $100 a piece from them, rolled on the truck, and that we were through them at camp.
That was big money.
Oh, yeah, that was big money.
Yeah, that was pretty good for those days.
I think one went to Prince George.
It wasn't left off at Quesnel.
Three places. But they come through all the way from down Quesnel somewhere with a pilot car and
just trucks. Well, the article I read is advertising the trucking business that hauled the coal. Explained it came from Brother's new camp. Doctor's.
Yeah, they had to build up the trunks right up to the level of the top of the cab.
Yeah.
And then shoot the poles right up in front of them.
That was the same winter that you got hurt in the bush when the axe cut you below the chin and you wouldn't come in the cookhouse because you would frighten me. Remember, before Lone Tree Farm. You're lucky you held it the way you did, as it was. You were pretty weak, but now you got to town.
Yeah.
One of my most embarrassing experiences of the pole camp was with Richard Lois, was just over a year old, but Buddy came up pole, and she was playing outside the cookhouse, and the men were working out in the bush a couple miles away, and any vehicle coming into camp had to go by the window at the cookhouse, so I just there by myself with her. And one day, it was the first trip that Toby Marshall called, but he logged up from the camp. It had been Scott or Ward or Charlie Smith all the time. Anyway, I was waiting for, it was just about lunchtime, and I was waiting for the men to come driving in. And there was a knock at the door, and Lois was outside playing. And so I thought, Lois was trying to get in, she couldn't reach the, you know, the door handle. And it was a... You had to lift it, you remember, the latch, and of course, shooting that small, the thing up there. But anyway, so I thought it was Lois, there's no one else around. And I was doing something at the stove, so I told her to come in, but I was just being silly, I dragged her to come in. And, come in, real silly like. And of course, the door didn't open, and so I knew she couldn't open the door, so then it knocked again, so then I really dragged it out. It was really... really dragged up. And so then I went over to the door, so I thought, oh, I'll just get down on my knees, you know, and give the door that to pull, you know, and just say, who? So I gave a pull, and I said, boo! And there was a pair of knees right in my face. Lois was playing on right around the other side of the cabin. And I was on my knees, and Toby looked down, and he said, are the men around? And I said, oh, I'm expecting them any minute, and I was looking straight up. Still on my knees. And I said, come on in. I said, you should be in for lunch in a minute. And he said, oh, no thanks, I'll go up to meet them. And he didn't come in either. I guess he thought, well, he kept me in the bush so long that winter.
Did he have a lunch?
Yes, so then he drove, he walked up to meet them, and well, he just went straight out, and he never did come into the cook house. And it was the only load trip he ever made. So he'd gone off to... had the trailer, and he'd gone off to the corner before he got to Chris Larmer's place.
Oh, yeah.
With the trailer, and he needed the cap to be pulled back onto the road, you see. So he met Wally, and Wally was straight out with him. And so Toby never did come. I don't know.
Burns's and our place were the only two places that had phones in the valley. For years, there was only one line. And when the operator was sending messages to the Yukon by Morse code, our phone bell would jingle constantly. We had a switch above the phone that we could pull at night to stop this noise. But then, of course, when we did this, nobody was able to phone in. The first radio we ever heard was... One was Charlie Janzy's. He was at the seventh cabin he was at the time. Anyway, he'd raise the receiver on his phone and put it close to the radio, and we'd listen in on ours. There sure was a bunch of excited kids then. The government... On the telegraph line, the government usually liked to have two men to a cabin, one working each direction on the line. But once in a while, the two guys couldn't get along, so one would move out either to the quarterway or halfway cabin. It was really a lonely life for these men there, and there was at least one suicide. Most of the linemen trapped during the winter, and some said they made as much or more during the winter trapping as they did with their wages for that time. I remember one story the Packers used to tell about John Jensen. He was a lineman, and they said... When he heard the bell mare coming, and this was the lead horse of the pack train, he would rush down the trail with a bucket with home brew in it and hand each one a drink as they come up the trail. Some linemen used to have extra supplies brought in with the pack train, like dried fruit and sugar, just for making home brew. I also know of one lineman that used to have extra supplies brought in to pay for pleasures from an Indian woman who was trapping with her family nearby. On one weekend, when I was staying with a Hagen family back in their pole camp about a mile from home, Art and I guess we would have been about 8 and 9 years old at the time. I went with Art out to set some traps out for squirrels, and hanging in a limb under a bushy old spruce tree, we found a coil of Indian-made cedar bark rope. It was made from the inner bark of the cedar. If I remember correctly, it was a three-strand rope and about 5/8 in diameter and about 20 feet long. It was perfectly made and was quite pliable. Being kids, we cut it in half so we'd each have parts. Whatever happened to the pieces, I can't remember, but we sure didn't realize the value of our find. Yes, for years, Thanksgiving was always held at the Burns Ranch, and New Year's at Campbell's, and Christmas at our place. Most everyone in the valley came to these dues. There was also a lot of house parties in the wintertime. I remember Fred Fulton saying that it kept him busy keeping his shirt clean to go to these parties. I expect he was like a lot of the guys in those days that considered themselves lucky if they had one dress shirt. These parties usually lasted until till daylight, as everyone was traveling either by team and sleigh or horseback.
Mrs. Campbell got me up to dance. I was just a kid, you know. We were doing the shotties or something, and she slipped and fell under the table, and that was it. I beat it.
Quite a gentleman. Oh, dear.
But I remember even at some of the dances in Christiaf and village, they all used to go down. Even they'd take the kids, remember? And they pile the coats and that on the stage, and the kids would lay on the... anyone who had the small kids.
Yeah, that's what was back then.
We wouldn't miss many dances in the village.
No, I understand, yeah.
But I always remember when we played softball, there was people, boys and girls and men, went from the, all the way from folks 10 years old till 60 or better, playing on the team. And we used to win some and lose some, but we played a lot with Kistrout Village and Glen Vall, and also at our time with the Hazleton team and the Upper Valley team. Some of these dudes at Kispiak, we'd all walk down in the afternoon to play ball. So we'd play ball, and after the game we'd go to somebody's house, either Harris's or Morrison's, for lunch, and then go to a dance and dance all night, and then walk home. On the way down, everybody was singing and whistling and joking, but on the way back, they were strung out all on the trail, and no one had much to say.
Well, this is a distance of about 7 miles each way, eh?
Yeah.
After working
yeah.
all day and get up early the next morning?
Yeah, wow. We used to go the old, down by Halliday's and then the old river trail.
Sounds like a lot of fun, and doesn't the cost be entertainment either? Play social life.
Yeah, get home just in time to milk cows.
No milking machines either.
They also had quite a few bees. In the valley, like building bees and clearing bees, where everyone got together.
They were almost like a social affair, too.
Oh, definitely.
It did seem lots of laughing a bit.
We danced after.
Yeah, those days people used to really help one another, and just whoever needed it, that's who they were, right?
Yeah.
I don't know which boat it was, there's so much on the boat. When did your dad first come to the country, Bill?
1908 or 1909.
He'd been in Revelstoke first.
Yeah, he'd been in Revelstoke and come here in 1908 or 1909. He had, of course, then he had to come up by Riverboat.
I wonder what boat that was. But
I don't know. I can remember him always saying that it didn't make any difference whether you were a paying passenger or not. You had it when they stopped along the river for cordwood, you had to get out and do your share.
You were going to sit in, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he worked on construction here. He worked on the Sealy Gulch Bridge and Porphyry Creek. I think he was running a donkey engine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, at that time, too, then he came to the place up the valley between Sweet and Nang East Creek, but across the river.
Oh, yeah.
About halfway in between.
Then you go 50 miles north, right?
Yeah. And never know exactly which piece of property gets emptied up there until I was guiding some hunters there in the early 1960s and seen this cabin there. So I went in the cabin, and I just happened to turn over a calendar. And there's the dad's writing in his name on the back side of the calendar.
His own handwriting,
yeah.
After all those years.
After all those years, so I knew it definitely where his home said.
Too bad you didn't keep that, eh?
Sure is.
Yeah.
It's all paid in now, isn't it?
Oh, is that interesting? Well, then he met your mom. She came out in April 1914, just a year after the railroad went through here.
Yeah, that was it. She was to housekeep for her two brothers. Mick and John.
Oh, yeah.
And I miss them.
Since you met your dad, and that was, yeah.
And then they took over the two quarters that Uncle Mick and Uncle John had created. So our dad gave up the property way up the valley.
But I always remember Dad telling about most of the stuff they got in there had to be packed in on their back, and I remember him talking about him and Alec Olson had gone to town, and Alec had was packing out some windows for his cabin, and he got up there and he took his pack off and set it down, and then he stepped back and put his foot through the glass.
Oh, didn't that make you cry? That's when he was way up the...
Yeah, that's when he was
50
miles.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that hurt me. Well, then your mother, Grandma Love, lived on the home place that was her brother's place until 1968, when she moved on up the valley further.
Yeah, they spent one year when Francis and Dorothy were small up at
the Hefner
place, which is where...
Lately,
you've got to call it the Den place, but at least people I knew Foster's on it now.
Oh, uh-huh.
When she first arrived from Sweden in April of 1914, she came to keep house for her brothers, John and Nick, and they had paid her fare to come out under conditions that if she wanted to go back in a year's time, that they would pay her way back to Sweden.
Well, being bachelors, her brothers bought new curtains, which they thought was a great improvement. They wanted to fix the place up before she came. When Mom arrived and they asked how she liked the house, she said she was really pleased and found it much nicer than she had expected. Only one change she wanted to make, and that was to get rid of those horrible curtains.
In the Kiskios Valley?
I don't know exactly the year, but
it was on Patty Sheen's property.
It was on Patty Sheen's, it was a couple of years before the Four Mile School opened up with it, but it's in an old cabin down towards the river that Clemson, who formerly owned it used to be Clemson's place, who formerly owned that place.
And didn't he trade places with Patty Sheen? Patty had lived over in the Clemson place.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. So that school was on Patty Sheen's property then, and Charles Neal was the first teacher there, right?
That's right.
Oh, yeah. And
I guess the Sheens had about enough children of their own for the school. I'm not quite sure, but there was another family, the Davidson family, but
I'm not sure
whether
they were
there when the school opened or not.
Oh, yeah. Well, Patty had a post office in his house and a weekly mail run in the valley with Old Riley and the buggy, eh? And
cutter in the winter.
Oh, yeah. And at 4 Mile Turnoff, there was a small log building, about 5 by 6, had blue flowers growing on the dirt roof every year, right?
Well,
it
stood there for years, and we always spoke of the corner there as being the mailbox.
Oh, yeah. And also supplies were left there as well.
Sometimes, there'd be a sack of shorts or...
You never know what might be in
there,
right?
Flour or whatever.
Oh, yeah. So he would go to Hazleton then and pick up the mail, right?
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was quite a trip, too. Well, it was 1924, I know, that Miss Lauder was the first teacher there to 4 Mile.
We went to school in Hagelin's house while they were building the old 4 Mile school.
Well, you had to go because there weren't enough students.
Well, I had to start when I wasn't quite 4 1/2 to make number 8. So there was enough to open up the school.
Oh. Well, Mrs. Hagman donated that property for the schoolhouse.
Yes,
right?
they donated the property where the schoolhouse was built.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Well, there was a party there one time that we recall hearing about the Halloween party, and you and Wally ran up to back of your place somewhere to get wood for a bonfire. And I guess Wally and old, what was the mule's name, Jenny or?
Jane. Yeah, we were cutting wood, and we had the chain and single tree hooked on to the mule. And while we were cutting, finding the old mule, she was bugging for that anyway. She finally took off. Wally run after, and it was, I don't know how it happened, but he slipped and fell, and the chain on the hook on the chain rather caught in his belt and clothes, and it dragged him down the trail, and I run after him, and heck, there was a few logs across the trail, and there was Wally's blood on the logs and on the rocks, and boy, it must have done for half a mile, I guess.
It's scary for you too.
It sure was, and here, I guess the last stitch of clothes of Wally's gave way, and the mule went on home. And Wally never even passed out. He was getting up when I got started.
Well, you can take it from me, Bill. He's still carrying the scars.
Well, I imagine so.
Yeah, he was in the hospital quite a while.
Oh, yes. His hips were just all jelly. Well, there was, as I said, there was blood on the rocks and on the logs where he flopped over.
Oh,
but at the start, he had the presence of mind to hold on to the chain in front of him, so he kind of pulled himself over these logs.
He'd only be about 10 or 11 at that time, right? Somewhere in there.
Oh. So that was, that's we didn't get out any wood, that's for
no,
sure.
No, I guess not.
We got along real well with the Indians in the village. Dad used to be called to the village at times to work on cow that was sick or having problems calving, and also on horses that were sick. As the Indians in those days had quite a few cattle and horses. Isaac Brown, who lived in the village but owned the property that Ann and Pat Hayes now live on, had four or five pack horses he used every fall to pack supplies into his trap line. Dad wintered these horses for Isaac for years. In the spring, when the grass came, Dad would turn the horses out on the range. During the summer, old Isaac would see Dad and pay him for the wintering. One spring, Dad had just turned the horses out when he got a phone call from the preacher in the village saying that Isaac wanted to see him. When Dad went into Isaac's home in the village, Isaac was lying on a mattress on the floor. He asked Dad if he had a blank check. When Dad told him he didn't, Isaac sent Dad up to the preacher's for one. After Dad made out the check, Isaac had put his mark on it, he said to Dad, "Jack, I know I'm going to die soon, and I want to pay you before I do." It was only a few days after this that Isaac passed away. I'll always remember when Dad died in 1940, the members of the Kistrock Brass Band asked us if they could play at Dad's funeral. The village had a large and exceptionally good band in those days. I know all of us considered it a great honor having them asked to play at this time.
What was Mann selling for, say, about 1940, say, here in the valley?
Well, I know we were offered the Sheehan place, which is now known as the Dundas place, for $300. Scotty McRae owned it at that time, and he wanted Bill and I to buy it, no written agreement, and pay as we could. But in those days, that seemed like a lot of money to us. We were afraid of debt, so we backed off.
Well, later on, you know, we bought it. That we lived up there, and you bought it from Ron and Jesse Dundas, and that was 1962. And you paid what, $8,500 for it. Not saying what it'd be worth now. How about taxes back in, say, the 30s? Didn't you have to work the taxes out, Bill?
Well, nobody had any money, so they used to let us work out our taxes. And we used to get $3.20 a day per man, plus $3.20 a day for team and wagon. So that was $6.40 a day. So we used to have to work maybe 3-4 days to work out our taxes. And then sometimes they used to give us a few extra days, so we'd get a little cash. And we used to think it's just like somebody's handing us money on a silver platter. It's $6.40 a day. Boy, that was big money.
Wow, big money, eh? Yeah. And then the road was opened only once a year, wasn't it?
It was plowed out once
in
during the winter. But, of course, most was traveling with the team and sleigh in the wintertime anyway. And Dad, when conditions were right, he'd travel the river from the Kistiox village to Hazleton to save pulling the hills if he had a load.
You sure couldn't have done that in the last few years.
No, that's for sure.
It's a swimming to do.
That just shows how weather has changed over the years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We used to get 40 up to 50 below then for stretches.
Yes, I guess so.
I remember always at Christmas time, the holidays, the concert, and we opened the school door and the steam would roll in along the, or fog, you know, along the floor.
But still, everybody would be there, whether they had to travel, and they all had to travel by team, in most cases, anyway.
Yeah. Oh, that was a big event of the year, right?
Well, both schools used to go together on the concert. The upper school.
Oh, when possible.
Yeah, would come down, or our school would go up. So they'd have the concerts combined.
Boy, that little old school of boxing, eh?
In October of 1945, Jack and I flew into Blackwater Lake, as it was the closest lake to Jack's trap line a plane could land. We took off from the junction of the Bulkley and Skeena Rivers. The plane was an old Junkers, one of Russ Baker's planes based at Fort St. James. As we flew north, I looked out of the plane, watching all the miles go by, miles that we would have to walk back. We almost had to walk back a lot sooner than we planned. After the plane had left, we packed all our supplies up to the halfway line cabin between 5th and 6th. This cabin was built on top of a steep knoll overlooking the lake. There was an old sheet metal heater with a flat top in the cabin. So after lunch, having lunch and coffee, we decided to go out hunting for a couple of hours and see what game sign was around, as we wanted to get meat as soon as possible to help save on the other supplies. When we got back in the evening, there was a small hole burnt in the split log flooring. I guess the old stove sitting and rusting over the 9 years since the line had closed down, and when we built a fire in it and the rust and metal heated up, a small piece had fallen out of the bottom and letting the hot coals fall on the floor. Why it didn't take off, the Lord only knows. Everything, all our food, extra clothing, and sleeping bags. We only had the matches we had in our pockets, plus a few shells and our rifles, and 150 miles to walk. So needless to say, the first thing we did was make up a pack of supplies, enough to get out on, and cast them high in a bushy spruce tree about a mile up the trail from the cabin. Talking about supplies, we had bought all our ours at the Bay of Hazelton. We bought a lot in case lots. When we opened a 25-pound box of macaroni, we found that mice had chewed a hole in one corner of the box, and this had been taped over and done in such a way it looked like it had been done when boxed. When we pulled the tape off, there was a dirty, greasy-looking hole where the mice had been going in and out. Talk about the urge to kill, as we had to pick all the macaroni over and use the macaroni that was not stuck together with mouse urine and droppings. When we raised heck with the bay manager, he swore up and down it had not been done in their store and must have been done before coming to their warehouse. As for getting meat, it was almost Christmas before any moose come into this area, and we were able to get one. This really helped on the other supplies. There was not a great abundance of fur around, and in fact a few years later one could have caught a lot more fur locally in the valley and with a lot less effort. We trapped till towards the end of January and then headed out for home, taking 10 days from Blackwater Lake. This seemed like a long time to go 150 miles, but snow conditions at times were such so you couldn't make many miles in a hard day's hiking. We got to the Burns Ranch late in the evening, and after a terrific supper, we went to bed in Burns' guest room. The bed was so soft that neither Jack nor I could sleep after sleeping on boughs for over 3 months. All the time we were in the bush, neither Jack nor I had a cold or were sick a day. But we were only home a few days when we both caught cold. We did have a pleasant surprise, though, when we got out. The fur prices had really gone up. Marten averaged over $70, female fisher, $125, wolverine, $25, and squirrels were even a buck apiece. We ended up with $4,000 for our catch, which was a lot of money in those days. Bill and Jack went back north for beaver trapping later that spring. Was in 1948. Jack and Francis had booked two hunters from Seattle to fly into Tatlatoo Lake, where we would meet them with a pack outfit. Jack had hired Norman Hagen and myself to help. We left Halverson's Ranch, which is now the Salmon River Ranch, with a real stampede, as we had 10 pack horses and 4 saddle horses. Some of the pack horses had not been packed before and didn't want to start then. We had horses and packs scattered around. It was the next day before we got everything straightened out again and got underway. We went the old Kitsigas Trail, which was in poor shape at that time. The bridge across the Babine River at the old village was something else. We led one horse across at a time and held our breath while doing it. From Kitsigas, the trail got worse, a lot of windfalls and swampy ground. Having some green pack horses and heavy packs was a bad combination. So needless to say, we had more problems and took more time than planned. Going around Bear Lake was the toughest going of all. Before we got to Bear Lake Village, we were wishing we had sent a lot of the foodstuffs in by plane so the horses could have traveled with lighter packs. When we got to the mouth of the Bear River, near where it runs into the Sustet River, we had to unpack the horses so we could swim the horses and take the packs across on a raft. Seeing a raft tied on the other side of the river, I told Jack I'd swim my saddle horse across and tie him up there and bring the raft back and move the packs across. This would save us from building a raft. Jack wanted me to take his saddle horse, old Spud, across as he was a good swimmer, but I wanted to try my saddle horse, Jim, which I had started riding that spring. The river was swimming water right from the shore. I had a little trouble getting Jim into the river, but finally jumped him in. At first he seemed to be swimming fine, then his back end began to sink and he went over backwards, putting me down deep in the water under him. When I started coming up, it was right under the horse's hooves, which hit me on the head, shoving me down deep in the water again. All this time Jack and Francis and Norman were going down the river towards where there was a rapids, as they figured no one could stay underwater so long without drowning, and also knowing that I could not swim. Well, the next time I started coming up, it was alongside of Jim. While I was still a few feet under the water, I looked up and could see my hat floating on top of the water. The ones on shore couldn't believe their eyes when they seen a hand come up and pull a hat down under. When I came up this next time, I came up alongside of Jim and hung on to the side of the saddle. After all the time, Jim was squealing and trying to make for shore. There was a long, slim pine pole on shore that the Indians had used to put out fish nets that Jack and Norman shoved out to me. But as they pulled me in, there was a steep bank behind them, so as they raised the end of the pole up the bank, this put me down deep in the water again. But they weren't long in dragging the pole and me out. When I got on shore, it seemed like I threw up half the water of the Sustet. We spent the night here, as we had to build a raft to take the packs across. When we took the horses across, Jack and I led one behind the raft, and Francis and Norman chased the rest of the horses into the water. From here on, the going got better. We got to Tutaddy Lake the day we were supposed to meet the hunters over the mountain at Tatlatui. When we heard the plane, we took the horses out on a sandbar and unrolled a white tent. Russ Baker, seeing us, landed his Junkers plane with the hunters. Before Russ left, Jack made arrangements for the hunters to be picked up at Tatlatui in a month. As game was real scarce, we did a lot of moving. I told Norman we should apply for a job with the circus when we got out, as we sure had a lot of practice setting up and taking down tents. The month the hunters were in there was quite enjoyable, as it was good country to travel with horses. We did see a lot of country. The hunters ended up with one caribou each, one goat, and one grizzly. The 3 months we were out, we only seen one moose, three caribou, a few goat, and a couple grizzly. Jack had been in this area in 36 with a survey outfit, and there were a lot of game there then. Every day they would see different bunches of caribou, but the wolves had almost wiped them out in the 13 years. There was no hunting done before this, only a few Indians at the village of Metzentan, which was on the east side of the Stickeen River on Metzentan Lake. These people had to leave the village because of the lack of game. Most of them went to work for Tommy Walker, who went north to Coldfish Lake to start a guiding operation in 48. Apparently, there was more game up in that area than in the area we were in. When the plane came in to pick up the hunters, it was a proud Russ Baker who stepped off the plane. He was flying a brand new de Havilland Beaver, serial number 1. This plane flew for many years, but I heard it is now in a museum. We finished the loading of the Beaver with packs which Russ took out to Fort St. James. After the plane left, we started the long trip home. When we got back to the village of Bear Lake, Russ was flying supplies in for Carl Hanawal, who had a trading post in the village. Jack sent out all the equipment out by plane and only kept enough to get home on. As soon as some of the horses had worms real bad. The chief Bear Lake Charlie had a son who was going out to Babine and said he would show us the way if he could go out with us. He said there was a lot better horse feed that way than the Kitsigas route. When we left the trail we had come in on and started towards Babine, some of the horses, even though they had no packs or rigging on, just gave up. We ended up losing 5 head before we got home. This was the only part of the trip that really bothered us, losing horses and not being able to do anything about it. I even lost my saddle horse, Jim. He drowned in a beaver pond one night, about 2 days before we got to Babine. He was one of the best saddle horses I ever rode. He was so trusting, even though I had almost had him drown in Susta. After this trip, Jack decided to guide closer to home, so started guiding in the valley. In the early 60s, we started moving the guiding north.